So here in Denver and Boulder, the new Jim Crow looks pretty active. In Denver, we have the second most lethal police force in the country, behind Baltimore. Yeah, that's from Center for Disease Control data. That's a study. That's not hyperbole. Mm-hmm. Boulder is also number two. We're the second most racist police force in the state for racial bias in arrests of African Americans, 5 times the arrest rate of everyone else. And you might think, well, and our police and city officials will tell you that, well, that's just because we have so few people, and when you normalize with a small number, blah, blah, blah. But I'm looking around, I see some people tonight who were at a Black Lives Matter, actually a Ferguson protest back in December, so December 13th. And there were about 100 of us, mostly white. And the first person they arrested was a Latino man on a charge of domestic violence that was associated with a Caucasian man in some other city. But they went ahead and arrested that very brown young man. And they later let him go, but the situation escalated, and the only other person they arrested was a black man from Boulder. And I watched plenty of white people, white women, white men get pushed, shoved, thrown to the ground, yell at police officers, get yelled at. They chose the African-American man right here in Boulder. So even since then, I've tried conversing with the chief of police and others about this. They don't see it. They don't see that as racist. I was actually told that good for us for not going back and arresting those white people. Good for us for being racist. That's what I hear when I hear that I'm lucky that that didn't happen to me or one of my white friends. Hmm. That's what the new Jim Crow looks like to me. Sorry if I cut you off, Dr. Rice.
Oh, not a problem. The disenfranchisement of looking at mass incarceration actually is the system of felon disenfranchisement. And in the process, what I'm seeing in the neighborhood, and I have owned a property in North Park Hill for about 30 years. I'm very disgusted about all that's happened in that neighborhood. Go 6 blocks south, and you can have a property 10 to 20 times value-wise. So the strategic work that's done in neighborhoods where blacks and brown exist are systemically impacted. They say there aren't ghettos in Colorado. We don't have the limitations, but as long as economics and power and control and legislation dictates what happens in communities, we are significantly impacted. The gang, I can't understand and never have understood why there are not constructive ways to deal with gang violence and some of those situations, and why the concentration is just in certain areas. My concern about how did the drugs get there? We don't have the resources to have surveillance cameras, planes that can evade surveillance. So there's a power and greed piece to all of this that impacts a people. It impacts a people to the point of, as he shared, not having housing. I'm very sad about that with that House of Representative person that didn't stand, but whoever is supporting you, you can easily get bought out, whether it's by banks or corporations. And so that's a sad scenario, no matter what the situation is. So I was sharing, I have a property that maybe at a high was about $250,000, but by all the incidents and the crack cocaine cases and those kinds of situations, it was easy to have those properties in the low hundred thousands or less, because if someone's cashing you out, you've lost in everything you have. There was a deception of a process of people having equity and moving to out-of-line places where we see this, which I don't understand, never heard of these kinds of things, but deserts, food deserts, where you don't even have multiple grocery stores, access to healthy food, victimized just in all kinds of areas, no less than a slave. I am equally ignorant and ill-informed about so much that's happened. I didn't realize that the start of this process really started near the time of the Civil War, during Reconstruction. This is not new overnight. This has systemically been in place, ways to evade and avoid the so-said freedom and liberation that was to exist. Even early on, after Emancipation Proclamation, there were same kinds of situations where black males were ticketed, loitering, too loud, standing around, thievery, and extremely abusive charges to re-imprison you as a slave and like a slave, which is no different than this mass incarceration. So we've got communities, not just here, all over this country. I was reviewing about racism in all states. All over this country, the sentiments that were so extreme, and clearly grateful for how far we've come, but seeing it roll back, losing ground, is disheartening and heartbreaking. And we cannot do this alone. We need everybody stepping up, being a part, using your sphere of influence to share this information, to share about the legislation, to share about the voting rights being turned back, and to just acknowledge that as a felon disenfranchised, all the civil rights one should have as a human being does not exist. We think criminalization, rehab, and all that to get people straight, it's not that, it's about a dollar. State of California, and any place as a model, has built 22 prisons in over 20-some years, and they built one college. So money, privatization, does not have to even line up with federal laws. So even minimum wage, you can pay somebody 63 cents. So that law I wanted to deal with in the Constitution is that you can hire people for nothing, a little or nothing, and run warehouses for corporations at the expense of the citizen who pays for the penal system, and you have people, in fact, that are making billions using minimal, not even minimum wage, but are using prison slave workforces.
So we're going to do one more question so we can open it up to a Q&A, and I'm going to ask our amazing panelists to keep your answers short because we've got lots of audience members who have questions for you. So we're here tonight to learn how to be an ally to the movement. So the first part of the question is, how do you define the term ally? And the second part is, what can we, many of us who in the room are Jews, what can we do to support the BLM while simultaneously deconstructing and refusing to participate in a white supremacist society?
I was going to say really quickly that, you know, as far as being an ally, it's something that's, I think, is an evolving definition. And you know, just because I sit here as a black person, I also sit here as a male and a cisgendered and heterosexual. And so I have more identities in which I'm learning how to be an ally than how to kind of define it for other people. But at the same time, I think part of it is just an intent. I had the pleasure of interviewing Michelle Alexander for my film on mass incarceration in the prison industrial complex. And this was late 2009, probably 2010, right before her book came out, and she blew up. So I can just like email her and be like, yo, can I do an interview? And she's like, yeah. And so, and she said one thing that really stuck with me was, you know, the capacity to care about people of other races as much as you care about your own, or, you know, fill in race with anything else, you know, that capacity that to empathize, to see that their struggle is bound with your struggle. as a person. But also, I think one of the biggest things that we can do is that we can empower ourselves to educate ourselves, mm-hmm. and therefore educating others, to not be silent when things happen, to be willing to put bodies on the line. I don't have the privilege of being able to speak out in the same way about the things that happen to me as many of the people in the room do, because I'm a given, mm-hmm. you know? I have an agenda, because my black skin provides an agenda. But, you know, I think that recognizing how much of how much fallacy has been put out there for your consumption, our consumption, and being able to challenge those things. When you hear someone say black on black crime, you say, what about white on white crime? That's what's really nuts, especially because when you're looking at sexual crime and crimes against your own family and different things like that, white people outdo black people tremendously. Mm-hmm. But we don't talk about white on white crime. We don't talk about those kind of different things. We don't talk about how the legalization of marijuana here has gone to mostly benefit white people, both economically and also that black people are still being arrested at astronomical rates versus their white counterparts for things like public consumption and things like that. I walk around Boulder as 0.9% of the black people here, and I smell marijuana all the time. I never see anybody getting arrested for it. you know? Those kind of things. I don't want to be too long. So just being able to spread the word mm-hmm. and challenge other people's notions about what is actually going on.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add to that, educating yourself. It's exhausting to be the only and constantly have to tell people about it. It's just a lot of work. And it's heavy stuff. And I am so appreciative of Rachel and other people who take it upon themselves, because privilege and oppression is not a black issue. It really isn't, and there's a lot of good stuff out there that's really easy to learn. Most of the time when I go speak, I just Google it and just say what they said, and so that's really easy to do. The other thing is I struggle with ally conversation. It confuses me half the time. I just don't understand it fully, so I don't really know if becoming an ally is an important thing if it's not action. I think a lot of people emotionally want to be accepted by the oppressed to feel like I'm good and I'm okay, and that's fine, but I don't really care about that as much in the sense of like the Facebook, you know, activists. It doesn't matter if you believe in justice, if you don't do anything. And so I don't really know how to talk about ally, but I do hope that people choose, if you're gonna do ally stuff, to do it as an action and not an identity, like a status, I'm an ally. You know, I don't care. I just want you to come and vote. So that's another thing, is voting and being super aware of who politicians are doing what, because we're the educated people. Like, we can know things about laws that most people of poverty or less education can't figure out. And I would say talking to your own people. So a lot of people want to come have dinner at my black church and get to know black people and be close to black people, and that's cool, but I need you to talk to your racist family or your auntie or those people that I can't reach, that I will never go to. Mm-hmm. The same way I talk to my homophobic family about gay rights. So I would say go to your people and spread the word and be that girl, be that angry black girl amongst your people versus me having to do it, if that makes sense. So it's very much action, and it's very much not being an emotional security for yourself, but kind of taking one for the team within your own community, if that makes sense. Yeah.
I want to just support what you said. I had that same consideration. And the rabbi stated something I wanted to say, and sir, if you'd repeat the justice. Sedek sedek tirdo. I wanted to say that, so I was going to seek clarity on pronunciation, but I sincerely agree. Use your sphere of influence mm-hmm. to address and deal with things from the cradle on, and in any way you can, and clearly legislative advocacy.
I just want to pass on something that was shared with me from Dr. Bianca Williams, who said, I prefer you not think of yourself as an ally, but an accomplice, because accomplices are right. in it. Yes. They don't come in and then get out, they're
guilty
in it.
Too.
And yeah, and I think it reflects, Angela, what good. You said of you know, how you have to live it every day. I can choose to step in and step out, but living it every day, Facebook posting every day and taking the backlash and doing it every day. That's part of the way you can start to experience, gosh, what's it like to live it every day as opposed to just be involved at this level, but accomplice. I like that word.
I like that.
Yeah, accomplice, that's great. I'd like to offer some ammunition to make this not about being altruistic, but actually being a liberator for your own selfish reasons. Not selfish, but your own real reasons. So Dr. King, in his speech after the Selma to Montgomery march, had a whole section talking about the origins of Jim Crow. And he gave this speech, and I'm just going to read a very brief passage. He uses poor, and I think certainly he was talking in economic terms, but I think he was also talking in spiritual terms. So he said, "It may be said of the Reconstruction era that the Southern aristocracy took the world and gave the poor white man Jim Crow. Yes, sir, he gave him Jim Crow. And when his wrinkled stomach cried out for the food that his empty pockets could not provide, yes, sir, he ate Jim Crow, a psychological bird that told him that no matter how bad off he was, at least he was a white man, better than a black man." So this is really the origin of Jim Crow. It's all about dividing. LBJ said it in far less articulate terms, but he basically was the same point. The point that I want to make is that we have to understand, and I think Angela and I share this, having grown up in very progressive households, and we were always taught that, you know, reach out to good people regardless of who they are. And when I started out with Black Lives Matter, I was like, well, you know, all lives matter, black lives, all lives. And the reason that black lives matter is that if we allow a system which is at its very fundamental basis from the beginning of time based on devaluing black life, if we allow that system to exist, then we devalue every life. Because by devaluing black lives, it allows lives of everyone to be devalued by the people who want to divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. So when you think about it, you're doing this for yourself.
Thank you. Thank you to all of our panelists. Thank you.
Thank you. That's better. So before we begin a period of Q&A, I'm going to say a couple things. Firstly, I'm going to say there are a lot of people here. I know a lot of people probably have questions. We have about 20 minutes for Q&A. So please keep your questions brief. And please, if it's not a question, if it's more of a monologue, then save it to tell someone over cookies later. And firstly, before we go into Q&A, I just want to ask for a huge round of applause. So we're going to have Q&A. After that, we're going to talk about next steps. So please stay, because that is a very, very important part of this evening. It's not just about showing that we feel like allies. It's also about learning and committing to what we're going to do to really be allies, to show up and stand up. So please wait till the end, because that's the important part there. I see a hand.
If this is irrelevant, then just go on to the next question. But do any of you know about Gary Webb?
Tell us about it.
Yeah. The investigative journalist that from the San Jose Mercury News that was probably killed, although it was said to be suicide, because he was exposing exactly what you're saying tonight.
Kill the messenger, right?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
I just wanted to know more about him. I just heard a little bit, and that was, 10 years ago he died, whatever. Anyway.
Well, there's a relevant point there. So back to this notion of our own self-interest. So part of the war on drugs, part of the protocol is when you find somebody with a low level or bust somebody for a low-level offense, an effort is made to turn that person into an informant. So North Dakota, not the black or brownest state in the country, Young man at North Dakota State, arrested, 20 years old, marijuana possession. They tried to turn him into a college student, tried to turn him into an informant. A month later, found in a ditch with a bullet in his head. This is what we do when we let ourselves be turned into a nation of fear. Mm-hmm. We fear black folks, we fear brown folks, we fear Arab folks, we fear gay people, and we let laws be put upon us to put away that or to salve that fear with illusory security. And what we end up doing is creating less security.
Yeah, thanks for your words. We know that there's been police violence and state violence for many years. I'm curious what people on the panel think sparked the Black Lives Matter movement. Obviously, we know Ferguson was an event, but I'm curious what your thoughts are around that event triggering this mm-hmm. kind of awakening or mass kind
Say
of awareness.
iPhones, video. It's the only difference. It got caught on tape. Ferguson was on tape, and they took the girl's phone, and they erased the video. And so that's what started most of the rioting there. Eric Garner, Tamar Rice, we just could see it. It's like the Ray Rice, the hit in the elevator. The NFL didn't do much about it until it was on video.
I think also there's a, does anyone else want to speak? There's an element of, I feel, cognitive dissonance. I feel like the level of anger and the level of this discord or gap between white privilege and white reality. I'm going to use a horrible word now, but one of the things that I say in a very sort of in-your-face way is we're all niggers now. Mm-hmm. Because the illusory privilege of being white is really not that powerful anymore because we're not needed. We can go around the world and source labor, we can source know-how, we can source all those things. During Jim Crow, in the classic sense, we could push aside a whole group of people, pay them less, and then pay a few people more. Now there's a whole world to pay more. Mm-hmm. And so you have that, and then you have a black man telling folks what to do, and folks are angry.
Obama.
That's just in case you don't know. So you have this perfect storm of a sense of white rage, essentially, a sense of loss of power, less a sense of world standing, and at the same time, you have a view that they are now being controlled by black folks, et cetera. So some of the things that you see happening, I think, are more violent and more vile because there's so much anger pent up. A lot of the things have already always been happening, and we just have film to show it, but I think there's a level.
Greetings. Hi. So I'm wondering how, in our community where black and brown folks, mm-hmm. Do we start addressing questions around gender? For example, non-conforming folks or transgendered folks who are also going to jail are about 56% rate of folks who are, you know, identify as transgendered people of color, conforming gender people of color, how we start changing the colloquial in our own communities and start having that discussion in our own communities about people of color who are in the LGBTQIAP spectrum and mm-hmm. your thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. We've doing it by just including. So we've all drank the juice of, you know, all the isms, I like to call them, and we all conform to them. And so when we lift up names like Eric Garner and whatnot, we also lift up other names, right? We've done it in our meetings where we include. I don't know if I'm curious of what you mean in terms of our own community, because we do talk about it in terms of it being included. And so maybe I can get more clarity on when you say, how do we talk about it? What you mean by maybe more?
Yeah, like I think for me, for example, coming from a Latino community, we don't even have a language for pronouns. Mm-hmm. So like that, I'm sure existed in just a larger mm-hmm. community. So how would we start addressing those type of issues within our community, and how would we engage ourselves, essentially? And I guess this is what I mean by our community. I'm talking about black
communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. So, well, go ahead.
Yeah, we just say we, you know, communities of color are you know, have a history of you know, perpetrating some of the same right. intolerance and lack of acceptance and understanding of other groups of people, especially based around sexual identity and sexual orientation. You know, I mean, my, you know, my own father is, you know, definitely, you know, a raging homophobic. And I think it's a matter of, you know, being able to really connect through empathy and having those conversations. So just as much as I want for people to stand up for me in a way that I'm not privileged to, I know that I have to do that hard work myself as well. So, you know, I have to have those conversations with people that are sometimes difficult around, you know, why, you know, the terminology that they've used, or, you know, why it's not acceptable for me to listen to, or, you know, you can turn on the radio and television, you know, especially within communities of color, and this idea of masculinity and different things yeah. like that, where blatant homophobia is celebrated and allowed. And so yeah. you just have to challenge those things just as you would, I think, others as well. But I think the conversation does need to be brought to the table so that it's not just a, you know, black and white. Even black and white of and of itself is so exclusive of the multiple identities that are going around. So I think mm-hmm. we just have to be better, we just have to do a better job of being inclusive of those identities yeah. and recognizing that, hey, I don't know everything. Mm-hmm. Even though I come from a place of being oppressed, I come from a lot of places of oppression too, so.
I would say human dignity. It, with all the divisions and all the different categories we can branch out to, if we put focus on human dignity and treating people equitably no matter what, their decisions pretty much is their personal business, but that all just can have the basic respect of being a human mm-hmm. in this world and being able to live comfortably and to the extent not intimidated because of some differences.
Just quickly, what I found with Black, I'm a part of Black Lives Matter 5280, and one of our events that we just did last week was lifting up women and transgender women in this Black Lives Matter movement. And one thing I realized when you're talking to a population of oppressed people, if you come to them and say, hey, but you're an oppressor too, it doesn't work usually. So you have to somehow validate what they're upset about first. And what I typically do is go back to the reasons. I'm a therapist. Why is masculinity such a big deal in Black community? Because Black men were torn down for so long. And so I validate the experience of their oppression and then show them how, we talked about intersectionality, show them how it's one big evil that's causing all of us different people to fight against each other and say, my oppression's bigger than your oppression, and rah, because we're all trying to be validated based on this thing. And I think it's capitalism, but whatever. You could say whatever that thing is, right? So in our conversation that evening, we talk about how within the Black Lives Matter movement, there's patriarchy. It's unreal, right? So I can sit there and yell at my Black brothers for being patriarchal and divide us and go our separate ways. Or we talk about, wait, why do, not you, but why would you feel the need to exert, he's a really good guy. You know, why would a Black male feel
she's
the need?
And her husband thinks so.
That's right. And we do that at home. But why would a Black male feel the need to exert his patriarchy over me? Let's talk about it. Well, because when I go outside, I'm just another nigga, right? And so I think when we, in these moments, when we bring up, well, the Black community is against, you know, gay people. And it's like, well, before we say you oppressor is wrong for another thing, you have to kind of work it into how, why are we all affected by this thing, whatever you want to call it? And how do we all relate to it? And if we can all understand each other's feelings, then we can start going, well, why do we do this to each other? And this has happened in the Black Lives Matter movement when it comes to gender or things like that, so.
So, speaking about capitalism, I know now that a lot, if not all of the states, have contracts with many thousands of public, private prisons mm-hmm. throughout the country. And so, in a recent review that was done, it was known that over 70% of the contracts that these prisons had with federal and state governments had a quota that the prisons had to meet. So the state had to feed them a certain amount of prisoners in order for the state not to be fined which is funded by our taxes, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you can speak a little more towards what we know about these contracts and how public policy or what people can do to engage in conversations around these contracts and what the limitations should be that prisons and states have to within these contracts.
That's a big aspect of the legislative advocacy. The private prisons do not have to meet the guidelines of the federal prisons. Consequently, they've got carte blanche back to olden days, as far as that goes. So the incentives are somewhat similar to like the police force. The more people you get on petty, not violent, murderous cases with a severe sentencing, but this kind of situation is a monetary, as you say, it's a capitalistic. These corporations are making billions, and they are actually, instead of putting a warehouse in a underprivileged area where people can't get a job, need support, have a felon, really need a job, the same people working for these entities cannot get a job outside, even though they're helping them secure billions. So you've got a double jeopardy in this instance, and this is what's the sad part, but it's payday, payday in so many instances.
Also, with the private prisons, you know, you have to recognize that any time that you are doing something for profit, then you're going to try to maximize profit and try to minimize costs. And so things like how they're dealt with as far as their health and well-being, again, the amount of money that they could be put into with certain work hours, the companies that contract for these inmates to work for them, as was said, can't get a job at that company after they've worked for them inside of the prison. And what's even worse is that a lot of times these prisons are put in those neighborhoods that are economically depressed, that are so hungry for jobs they'll take anything, right? And so you put this prison then in the community, and now you got people from the community who are vested in this job working at the prison, even though that prison itself is also harming that community by putting people in there. And so so then you have that division again that continues. And so think about how a lot of movements don't become dangerous movements until there is a wide diversity within the unity of people. How did slavery become racialized within the United States? When white folk, Jewish people get involved in the civil rights movement and different things like that. Something that you know, even Malcolm X was calling for before he got assassinated. Looking at how we build a broad coalition of people who come together. Now there's so many people touched by the prison system that, you know, if you think about it, whether it's your family members or not, or someone you know or something like that, everybody's eventually gonna be connected to the prison system. The Black Panther Party didn't necessarily become dangerous to the FBI until they started meeting with poor white people and started to coalition build. And again, that notion that white folks who might be poor and subject to the same conditions who are in these prisons as well, at least they're white folks, right? And they're not people of color. But what we need to recognize is that these private prisons are a system of perpetuating that slavery. And of course they're gonna have a quota, which means that they're gonna put people in prison no matter what to meet that quota. Now they have a line. It doesn't matter what the crime is. It doesn't matter the rates. It doesn't matter any of those things. You're going to jail so we can meet this quota. And so we're going to have this system continue as long as we allow for, once again, under the 13th Amendment, we allow for corporations, whether they're the private prisons or the corporations that we use every day, like Victoria's Secrets and TWA and Sprint and AT&T and all these, Dell, those corporations contracting the labor for prisons for pennies on the dollar to nothing. They're doing it legally. And as long as the law stays that way, we're going to continue to see that be the case.
Very quickly, so I'm glad you said I'm a good guy. Now I'm thinking as I say my background. So I worked for a time for the largest provider of correctional health care in the country, and it's based in Greenwood, Colorado. So what we did is provide healthcare in jails. It actually was a good company because what we were trying to do was not only provide healthcare but in the jail, but also reentry healthcare. Let me just give a very quick story. So when you go and do a contract in a jail, the first thing that you look at is ADP. That's average daily prisoners. So that's the number of prisoners that are in the prison divided by the number of days in the year, and you get the ADP. So a guaranteed contract gives the company providing either health care or that jail a guaranteed number of prisoners, whether or not they're there or not. So of course, the state wants to make sure that they're not overpaying. So they're going to either lower the number and not get, they're going to raise the number so that they don't get penalized for the shortfall. So you're generally going to have higher numbers of prisons. So there's an incentive to fill that number of beds so you're getting the service for what you're paying. That's basically the way people are thinking. So I think of the prison industrial complex as the cigarette industry, for example. So the cigarette industry, you had a bunch of folks who made billions of dollars off of all of our suffering, really, right? So what they did is they sold something that we then had to pay for, right? We had to pay for all the loss of life, the loss of vitality, etc. What the prison industrial complex is doing is exactly the same thing. They are taking taxpayer dollars, taking out taxpayers, and making them into wards of the state for the rest of their lives, making them into a caste, an underclass. What we have to do, part of the work that we have to do, is bring light onto that system. We have to show that you, without a moral compunction, are wasting money, destroying people's lives and people's vitality because you're scared. And we have to stop that.
Hi. Hi, Darren, Derek, how are you guys doing? As a Black Lives Matter activist myself, it's a tactical question. So I do exactly what you recommend, Angela. You go out there, talk to people, talk to, you know, yes, non-black folks.
Yes.
And invariably you'll bring up the name, the dreaded phrase, white privilege. And suddenly they're calling you racist.
Sure.
What do you do about that?
They call you racist for saying they have white privilege.
Yeah, because I'm being racist now against white folk.
Sure.
Okay, so what do you do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find it's funny when I'm black, so they might not call me racist. So I'm like, do people call me racist when I call them that? I think you all know it's how we say it. You know, it's how we, like I mentioned, I validate the experience of shame that comes when your privilege is exposed. I went to seminary, I was raised evangelical, went to a really liberal seminary and got hit with my Christian privilege like a ton of bricks. Mm-hmm. And I struggled a lot with it because I didn't know I had it. So when I'm walking up to random people on the street, you have white privilege, it's like, rah! And as a therapist, I guess I learned that I'm dealing with emotional dysregulation. Like, these are human beings, and I'm about to tell them that their heads are gonna tie themselves to slave masters immediately. And I'm not trying to say that, but I have a whole lot of knowledge in my head, and I've studied this, and I've read this, and this person is just a random person who's probably never talked about this in their life. So I tend to, I try not to do drive-by conversations, if that makes sense. Like, I was evangelical, so I used to pass out tracts and run. Like, I don't do that anymore because it's ineffective. But I find that I'm most affected with people I know. So people at work, I have a friend who's white. I have a white friend. And she, it's good to say that. It feels good to say it. And she goes, she's at her yoga class, and they're like, oh, what are you doing this weekend? Oh, I'm gonna learn more about my white privilege. That's all she says. And they go, what? You know, sometimes I go, okay, I'm not gonna talk about it. But she integrates it into herself versus saying you. So kind of we talk about, I'm not gonna go to my black community and be like, you're homophobic. I'm gonna talk about my moment of realizing my Christian privilege and how hard that was. And I validate it through my experience, and they go, me too, me too, me too. And then I'm safe, and then we can talk more. So it's sugarcoating, or at least validating, I guess. But some people just don't want to hear it, and that's okay. I don't force it. I just try to be, I try to be the fruit of the spirit. I try to be different, and then people ask me. But you have a harder task because you are white, so it's different, right? People respond to me differently. But you become that girl, right?
I'm myself.
Yeah.
I'm actually of Spanish background from
okay.
the Philippines. So I'm,
my, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm Asian, Latino, and white all together at the same time. So
go.
It's really hard.
Yeah. But no, I think you become you. One thing I tell people about allies is be ready to be misunderstood and yelled at and all that stuff. That just kind of comes with it. So it happens, you know. Mm-hmm. I hogged that. I don't know if there's any.
No,
you
was,
did that. Yeah, yeah, you.
We have time for just a couple more questions, so if you really, really want to ask your question, please raise your hand. Okay, great. You really want to ask your question. Okay.
Oh, thank you. Hey, this is a beautiful forum here tonight. Park Hill in the house. I heard it mentioned a couple of times. I got the shirt on. Hey, yeah, a couple of things. One, I can answer that one lady's question about Gary Webb. The drugs was flown in. You guys mentioned that earlier. The sister on the end, I forget. They're flying it in to the community in Oakland and California. That was the starting point. And Webb exposed it because one of the dope dealers in Oakland gave him the story, how they started it. Also with the weapons and the gangs. So that's, you guys can look up Gary Webb, and that's where you can find more information on that. Yeah, they did. They did, the whole country. But I'm saying it was started in Oakland, California, with the cocaine. Yeah, I lived in Oakland for 12 years. But anyway, that's how that happened. Reagan, same thing with the Contra. If you look at that whole historical with the Contra, guns and the weapons with the gangs. How were they getting the guns? Mm-hmm. These type of weapons and stuff in the neighborhood. So terrible. And it's still going on now. It's like a bad dream, you know, and it all ties together with the Jim Crow. But my question is, what do you guys see that we can do to get, or do you believe, or do you know that we should get reparations? You know, you like you said, we never got psychological help from the Willie Lynch mentality when we was let out of slavery. The 40 acres of mule, that we at least could have got a land and some mule, planted some food, you know what I'm saying, and build a home or whatever. But what are your thoughts on reparations and psychological help? Because the sister up in Oregon that has the... what is like the army, people get it in the army, what is it called?
Oh, yes. PTSD.
Yes, post-traumatic stress slave syndrome. Mm-hmm. That's what she called it. Joyce up in Oregon somewhere. But anyway, what do you guys think? Where you at on reparation?
Go ahead and take that.
Oh, no, I don't much say. No, it's not that I have so much to say. I do want my 40 acres and a mule. Yeah. I sincerely think it's significant that PTSD slavery syndrome, I think it's all significant that it's acknowledged, that it's addressed, and that we're doing work, legislative-wise and otherwise, to deal with it, because it's hidden, it's undercover, it's dismissed. But I think it needs to be honored, and I think that's a key legislative advocacy for us to dig up the history and start to do work on it. I encourage you to take initiative with that as well and draw us in.
Yeah. There's Dr. Joy DeGruy who talks about that post-traumatic slave disorder. And I think that reparations should come in a form that's, you know, we think maybe it might be, you know, monetary or things like that, but I think that there are a lot of systemic issues that can be reversed, and then also some systemic issues that could be created to help to level that playing field for things that might be a little, even in some ways, more valuable than just money itself. But I also think that would have to be a movement that would be a little bit more demanding of society in general, and I think part of it is that because, I don't know if Angela Davis is the first one to say this, but I heard it from Angela Davis, that we inhabit a country that encourages historical amnesia.
Mm. Yes.
And so
yes.
f- first, before there can be reparations, I think that we have to really have go through the tough process of getting everyone else to understand why there need to be reparations in the first place. Because although we have, although we know slavery existed and all these kind of different things, we have an overwhelming mind frame that says, well, that was the past, get over it. Stop. It's gone, it's over with, you know. And I ask people, what year did racism end?
Yes.
Tell me what year racism ended since it's over. Be able to show me a problem that you are all usually able to solve without communicating about it, without going through that process. And I think that that's something that needs to happen before reparations could be realized, even though I believe in them fully and wholeheartedly.
Exactly. Thank you. One more question.
I just want to hit on that for a moment to say, if you look at the wealth gap, the income gap that has grown in the last 30 years, and then you see, you know, I think it used to be 20, 30 times as what people made if they were a CEO versus a production worker, and now it's 300, 350 times. That curve is continuing. And we spent, after the economic crash in 2008, we spent trillions on quantitative easing and creating money from nothing, and it has all gone to the top. Imagine if we took a few trillion just like that and gave it to the folks that are asking for reparations for a better start. We wouldn't feel it. We didn't feel those bankers get all that money. I feel it. But, you know, we wouldn't feel the pain near as much as we think we would, and it would be a tremendous change. And the last bit of that is I heard, I believe, an African-American man on KGNU talking about how if we gave people houses and money, it takes 5 or 6 generations before that starts to stick. So we can't, you know, even reparations can't be here's our one-time deal, go make it work, because that's a recipe for disaster.
Thank you. One final question.
I am an educator in Denver Public Schools, and I'm curious what you think is the most important issue to address in education and how we address it, because there are so many. Yeah. Access to high-quality schools, discipline in schools, higher education. Yeah. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Rewriting the history books. Right. Where do you think we should go, and how do we go there?
I'm so biased. I'm not a part of the education system, but I would love everyone to get free therapy. Because honestly, I tell my families, kids come to me because of behavior, and then I tell my families, go find a therapist. Oh, really? It costs $150 an hour. So then they just go back to normal. And so if there was more mental health services in general that could help people deal with the emotional trauma, the historic trauma, but mental health is so thrown to the side. So, I mean, I'm not in education, but that's my bias, is if there could be just more mental health services for families.
The education piece and educational lack of equity is a serious, serious problem. Whatever is feeding into it has even a tie into the new Jim Crow, because the families have been disenfranchised. You don't have a foundation. You have just so many missing pieces. And we also often aren't mentioning, too, the women also that are part of this process that are imprisoned. So you have the father's gone, the mother's gone. You've got a breakdown in the family system overall. So there's a devaluation for education. Something is wrong systemically in this country that, compared to many other countries, education is a high value. We will pay money for just about any and everything, but we will pay for prisons and not for schools. We don't give the support to educators that's needed so they can do their job and they're supported. And the schools have turned really into almost like a model of a prison system. We invited the policing into the schools that's tying into that pipeline. So we really need the tutoring, the support. We need the school aligning in all kind of ways with churches and other organizations and getting the tutoring and support to buffer up these fragmented families, which is a large part of society. And the branches of this bit is the education, the housing, the mental health. So many things are just in trouble. The stress level of trying to exist when there are so many men imprisoned and women in prison, and the women related or allied with the men imprisoned are broken and struggling, unable to be at home. So the system, even of education, needs some transformation to support and accommodate these single family homes without the support that's needed. It is complex, but we at least can start with the nurturing and support that we can, and the work within that school systems, systems that exist, which requires legislation to get the funding that we need so those schools can be a support and a nurturing for the young people.
I want to affirm that, and I think that the things that you're getting at is that we have a society whose system does not serve it. And I think one of the biggest things that we can do as people allied, as comrades, is unravel the myth. That's right. We need to start talking about the fact that rugged individualism was never really the story. We had a nice document, and we've been fighting ever since to make the document real, right? 1776, July 4th, white men who weren't Quakers, who weren't Jews, who weren't Catholics, who owned property, could vote. That's about five people in this room. Everything else that we've done, we've had to struggle together to do. In schools, I have a friend who's they've set up a homeschooling network of 50 families in Atlanta. And without going into detail, what they've done is they've brought single parents together. They've brought, you know, two-parent households together. They've done the it takes a village to raise a child. And they've created a program that says, we love our kids. Our kids that are disruptive are dealing with issues, and we're gonna bring them in. We're gonna teach people to share their humanity. We have to start thinking about things like this and stop thinking about everything's a bottom line, everything's a test, everything is profit. We've gotta start thinking about community building each other up and helping each other, raising the barn together.
So Malcolm X said that the greatest nation in the world will be the one that spends as much on education as the US does on war. The education has to be invested in this society. From the manner in which we fund education, we are saying that because you live in a poor neighborhood, you deserve to go to a poor school. Education is a privilege and not a right in our society, and we need to change that. And on top of that, we need to become responsible for our own education. We can't say that whatever our school feeds us, whether we're in an affluent neighborhood or a poor neighborhood, we're all being fed an education to structure us for a certain design. And we have to be responsible for our own educations, and we have to say that our educations have to be, again, as was said, more communal. And so we can't just rely on that building because we know that no matter what end of the spectrum you are, you're in a faulty situation.
Just real quick, you know, a lot of what I heard is living wage. You know, we need mothers and fathers to be able to be home at night with their kids, reading, teaching. We need them to be able to feed their kids in the morning. There is a living wage movement,
right,
even right here in Boulder. In our state, you can't change the minimum wage because it's a state law. But in Boulder, that's been a platform that people are starting to pay attention to. But my feeling is it's lost a little steam. The Human Relations Commission that meets, I think, the third Monday of every month, look it up, is still listening about that, and certainly city council will listen to that. We can change that. If this whole room showed up at a city council meeting and said, we demand a living wage, I tell you, it would be high on their list of things to do, or at least backpedal on very carefully. So I hope
that's
to
right.
see you there.
Yeah.
Thank you. Go give them a round of applause.